an imagination for dealing with the context over here. Because it's how those two come together that is really at the heart of what preaching is all about. I'm not going to be talking about the preaching task per se, but I hope that some of the kinds of perspectives that I bring into this can be helpful to those of you who are engaged in that kind of task. What I'm saying, therefore, is that theology is what occurs when the Christian community knows itself to be living between the text and the context, between the revelatory answer and the human questions, which is the way that Paul Tillich, for example, put it, or between the Bible and the newspapers, which would be the way that Karl Barth referred to it. Theology is that ongoing activity of the whole church that aims at clarifying what gospel means here and now. And here I take for my clue, and one of the theologians through the years that I've really followed a lot is Douglas John Hall, and how he refers to gospel, not as the gospel, but gospel. Gospel not as a fixed, prescribed, once and for all codification of truth, but good news. What has not yet been heard or known, what has a kind of surprise element, seeing what we may not have seen before. I think there's an interesting complement between the seeing kinds of metaphor that Scott was using and what I'm going to be talking about. Bringing into being a new realization, a new situation, not what is rote and predictable, but what is typically subversive of the status quo, of what we take for granted. A subversive remembering is a phrase you're going to hear again and again, because I keep trying to play around with how I think more and more in our time and place, subversive remembering is the heart of the task of the church. But more on that later. So, following through on what Paul says, gospel is news that is good because it challenges and displaces the bad, offering another vision of what could be. And, of course, the bad news is always changing, or at times seems to be coming ever worse. Therefore, what becomes crucial is ongoing discerning of the situation into which news that becomes good is preached, taught, and embodied. And in that sense, one size does not fit all. For example, if we say, well, yes, Jesus died for your sins, that's, you know, as long as we repeat that again and again, or even things that are very valued to us as Lutherans, the importance of justification. But what is it that is really enslaving or locking people in today? About 3 years ago, we had a consultation of Asian theologians, and Vitor Vesthala, who teaches at LSTC, was there, and he presented a very provocative thing, which the Asian theologians there really were struggling with, because he said, is in fact the lock that is enslaving you the same as the lock of the 16th century when Luther's theology was cast? And does the key, therefore, fit the lock in the same way? And he really challenged them to think about that. And I think we could think of a number of ways in which that happens, too. In the 1970s, when I was doing my theological education, a number of us women began to say, well, is the usual formulation of how we see sin as too much pride, is that an adequate way of talking about the reality of sin? Or in the 1980s, when I was working on my dissertation, trying to rethink theology in light of white working class experience in this country, how do we need to think again how those theological connections are made? Now, by that, I'm not saying that the text side, especially all the history of doctrines, is not important. It's important to know that. But we're talking about how do you creatively talk about those symbols of our faith, those texts of the Bible, speaking with a new urgency and a new relevance in terms of what's going on today. In that sense, what I'm talking about is very similar to what we might refer to as confessing. Confessing in contrast to professing faith in Christ. That involves discerning what Luther referred to as, quote, the little point which the world and the devil are at that moment attacking. Confessing hinges on what is actually occurring today in our context. And only as we grapple with and hear it ourselves will we be able to proclaim it freshly to others without falling into predictable and perhaps boring formula. As Hall puts it, to confess is to rediscover the meaning of the faith under changing historical conditions. It asks what needs to be said here and now. In confessing, we bear witness to the source of our hope and life in the face of the violence, the pain, and the fear that surround us. So what I'm suggesting is that confessing be understood as a power discourse in the midst of systemic injustices, social amnesia, and illusions. I'm going to say something else and have something up here about what I mean by each of those words. Confessing is a subversive declaration of who and whose we are in the midst of those forces today that would dominate, oppress, and shape us according to their power and interests. More than only words, it is a stance of defiance in the face of those realities. It is inevitably contextual, and it inevitably becomes public. Involves ourselves with what we might think of as political realities. It is something that emerges from beyond what is, as an effective power that activates us with new life and gathers us together as the body of Christ, an organized community of resistance, empowered to cooperate and organize with others to resist those powers that are reigning over our lives and in our world. In other words, this kind of confessing plunges us into the heart of things, and in that sense becomes radically incarnate in the world. Real participation in the world of suffering and disappointments, and exposing what's going on rather than covering it over with platitudes or avoidance of what might be seen as too controversial to name or to talk about. We cannot sit back in a neutral space. It inevitably becomes public, but in ways that inevitably have to do with realities that are more than just individual or private. And therefore, it forces us to read again what Scripture is saying in terms of all those various texts that really have the backdrop of some of these political and economic powers of domination that people in the Old Testament or the New Testament times were struggling with. So I said already my kind of impatience with, you know, the fact that we spend a lot of time on the text, which we should. I don't want to in any way neglect that. But on the other hand, how do we understand the situation? How do we understand that not only in relation to the U.S., but in relationship to other realities globally? And this is where, especially in what I do tomorrow, I'm going to say how that being interconnected globally through a communion, how we are organically interconnected with one another throughout the world, how that itself helps us to see and leads toward transformation of how we understand ourselves as Christians in this part of the world. Their realities wake us up, compel us to see what we would not otherwise, to question, and through the power of the Spirit to be transformed in and with those who are most different from us. Now, when North American theologians or theological students think of contextualization, they typically think of contexts different from their own, such as Africa, Asia, Latin America. But as Kenneth Matata, a South African theologian who actually now sits in my office in Geneva, has pointed out, contextualization has to be more than just global South participants providing the raw context upon which the global North does its reflecting. In fact, he would say that's a kind of instrumentalization that goes on or being used. And so actually in 2006, as part of a five-year Theology in the Life of the Church program that I directed in as part of my position in Geneva, we brought together a group of North American theologians to reflect theologically on what it means to be the church in the midst of empire. That was difficult. That was a difficult project, even though we had some very skilled theologians involved in that. The book that came out of that, which there's some copies available in the bookstore, as well as two of the other books from that series. I think they're only $10. At least that's what they're supposed to only be priced at. So you can see what some. You can also order some of those. But what I'd like to do. But I think in some ways, the book is dated now, because I think to more and more people in this country, the kinds of realities that we tried to chart out there has become all too evident. And if anything, there's lots of signs of, well, is U.S. as an empire declining? You know, what's happening? You know, are we seeing ways in which that kind of power that has been associated with the U.S. in the past is being challenged? We're going to get a little bit more into that tomorrow, especially some of the American exceptionalism kinds of logic that's been a part of that. But let me just pause for a minute, both to, if any of you have some questions of what I've said thus far, but also what I would invite at this time is your just naming very quickly some of the observations or developments that you think should evoke our theological outrage as Christians or as a church today. I'm going to say some things too, but I want to just get a sampling of where some of you, how some of you might name some of that.
I see in many respects in our religious culture kind of emptying Jesus of the actual content of his ministry and message. Mm-hmm. So he becomes kind of a cipher, and we can keep that thing like, well, you know, we're saved by the blood of the cross or something like that. And then we just kind of fill in a few things. And then actually we tend to jump somewhere else altogether different, something from Leviticus or wherever, and make up a version of Christian faith.
Mm-hmm. Other quick readings. Carol?
Or this statistic, almost the new poverty data that's just come out, you know, 15% of Americans, you know, highest ever, historically highest ever, and almost half of 25 to 34-year-old young men are below the poverty line, almost half. We're not talking about, you know, 25 to 34, and the implications that has for people starting families, you know, having.
Okay, other quick names. Ross.
This is not a new thing, but the fact that, especially in the United States and other countries, but the wealth is so unequally provided, the goods, the resources are very lopsided. There are some individuals who have most of the money, and that, and we are each individuals, but the bulk of the people are not equally careful in all ways, food and healthcare and everything. Why we don't, some countries look out for all of their people.
But the gaps are just becoming.
But they're getting really, it's getting really bad this spring, yeah.
325, the CEOs of the largest 25 companies earn 325 times what the average worker in those companies.
900 for Walmart, 900.
Okay, a few other, I want to do some just quick things, because we don't want to dwell forever on this, because I don't want you all to go to sleep on all of this.
Sure. Can a layperson interject then?
Sure.
But as a layperson, all of these problems that we're talking about, that we know about, we read about, limited, you know, I have a limited sample, but I don't hear any of that discussed from the pulpit. I mean, hardly ever.
We're not reading names.
Right.
I think exaggerated individualism.
Okay.
The vast amount of money that our country spends on military, particularly in comparison with all of the rest of the world.
Exactly. More than the rest of the world
combined.
John?
Well, in response to what was just said here, that in the common understanding of Christianity in America, the concerns are not any of these concerns, but rather with returning to some pre-existent situation. It's not even status quo anymore. It's what things used to be.
At least an idealized version of what used to be. One more comment.
Human effect on creation and our lack of stewardship.
Okay. Good. I shouldn't say good, because none of these are good. But I think, you know, just to sample a few of these things, and of course, as I said, I don't want to spend all the time going over those. But what I'd like to do is to... Now we need this on. Where's our... I'm going to at least mention three threads that the first of these may be a rather familiar one, but I'm going to talk just briefly, and I put this up on slides so that you, if you're getting a little weary, you can say, oh, I can't understand those words, so you can see as well as here, okay?
Takes a bit of warm up.
Okay. Okay, the first of these, is the whole web of domination and set of injustices that increasingly has been referred to as empire. Now, there's lots of discussions about empire. I would, by the way, just mention that I think one of the helpful ways in which that's discussed is Jörg Rieger's book, Christ and Empire, which is listed there. It's a Fortress publication. And he refers to empire as the various interrelated processes of domination and their effects, or the massive concentrations of power which permeate all aspects of life and which cannot be controlled by any one actor at all. And I think this is the kind of feeling, so overwhelmed by all of that, especially in terms of when we discover the huge upsurge of corporate power and how that is controlling not just economic but political life, and especially some of the funding of some of the political activities, and how that's being traced, and what some are saying is a corporatocracy. I can't even say the word.
Kevin, would that be too big to fail?
Yeah.
You mean in a nutshell?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Too big to fail, and a few other things we could attach to that too. And just to point out there, certainly without going into a lot of this, which I think some of you are familiar with already, Christ's special connection to the underside of empire is manifest throughout his earthly ministry, and especially his being crucified by forces of empire. Yet if Christ has overcome the powers of domination associated with empire, then the calling of the church is to proclaim and live this out in ways that, I would add, probably resist, that resist, overcome, transform, rather than replicating patterns of domination that mark empire. Since I first started thinking about empire and the challenge that raises for us at church, you know, part of it is realizing how much of those kinds of logics also permeate us as the church. You know, so it's not a matter of saying, oh yeah, that's those terrible powers over there. But no, you know, it's you know, here the Pauline understanding of, you know, we are also, it infects who we are. And therefore, it's in naming it this way, I'm not saying it's just something out there. It's something that our members struggle with regularly. How do we find ways to name and to make those connections so that people can hear gospel in some new and fresh ways? Resistance to empire is difficult since most people never realize what it is that shapes them, that reaches all the way into and creates their deepest desires. I'll have some more things to say from Rieger's book, anyway, it's his one book is in the bookstore for sale. And he says consumerism is not the problem. Desire, how our desire is shaped. In other words, even more, you know, basic in terms of going to the core of who we are. Resistance to empire happens when ambivalence is acknowledged, where the pressures of injustices are greatest, and when tensions are not prematurely resolved. Again, this is where I'm going to try to pick up on this thread of subversive remembering, which I think is key.
Do you have an example of that?
When people really acknowledge, you know, name the gap between the promises, you know, that they've staked their lives on, and in fact the reality, you know, which I think is a time of lament, of mourning, and all the rest. The question is, how do we stay with that? You know, how do we linger with that? How do we, and again, I'll say a little bit more about this in the morning. I don't want to go too much into it right now. So I'll mention all three of these, then we can just talk about them for a little bit. That's not it. Social amnesia. Now, some of us who are getting older may spend a little time thinking about, you know, not wanting to have individual amnesia. But one of the commentators, and I find that theologically, to connect with some of those secular commentators, they often have a sensitivity for what are some of these deeper theological questions that I think we need to have the courage to then pick that up and say, how do we address some of that theologically? Henry Giroux has written, and this is a number of things I put together in one slide, a number of things that he said. Historical consciousness and truth are now sacrificed to the spectacles of consumerism, celebrity culture, hyped up violence, and a market driven obsession with the self. But the very formative culture that makes compassion, justice, and an engaged citizenry foundational to democracy has been erased from the language of mainstream politics and the diverse cultural apparatuses that support it. Unbridled individualism, named over here, along with the gospel of profit and unchecked competition, undermine both the importance of democratic public spheres and the necessity for a language that talks about shared responsibilities, the public good, and the meaning of a just society. Public values and the public good have now been reduced to nostalgic reminders of another era. I'm not talking about, well, the Great Society or some other past era. Market-driven values get normalized by erasing any viable understanding of history, memory, power, ideology, and politics. Without the necessary formative culture that can provide Americans with a language that enables them to recognize the political, economic, and social causes of their problems, without that, then a politics of despair, anger, and dissatisfaction can easily be channeled into a politics of violence, vengeance, and corruption, feeding far-right movements willing to trade in bigotry, thuggery, and brutality. Then a third way of looking at what's going on today. This one actually comes from Chris Hedges, who I think went to Harvard Divinity School and then was a New York Times journalist for a while. He's been very disillusioned about that. And again, sometimes he maybe pushes things a little bit over the top. But this will be my point of departure for especially talking about how a theology of the cross, especially as a way of knowing, has a possibility, I think, of exposing these illusions. In other words, what I'm trying to do in each of these cases is to say, hey, let's think creatively about how these central critiques of what's going on today open up and challenge us. You know, how do we think theologically in the midst of that? And that's part of what we're going to want to do through this week. Hedges has put it this way. We live in imaginary virtual worlds created by corporations that profit from our deception. A public that can no longer distinguish between truth and fiction is left to interpret reality through illusion. I suppose one could also add here all of the things that have come out lately of saying, well, you know, there's no climate change, you know, ignore science, etc. Truth is what I find believable, according to my criteria. The worse reality becomes, the more people seek refuge and comfort in illusions. Lies and distortions become truth, and people can believe what they want to believe. Blind faith in illusions in our culture is our culture's secular version of being born again. The culture of illusion, one of happy thoughts, manipulated emotions, and trust in the beneficence of those in power, although probably we could say now that's an all-time low in terms of whether people trust whoever's in power.
Well, it's not just political power. It would be corporate power in this one.
I think it's talking about a combination of the two here.
As your theory.
That means we sing along with the chorus. In other words, we go along with those illusions, or are instantly disappeared from view, like the losers on a reality show. So let's reflect or comment on these three: the empire, the social amnesia, the illusions instead of truth. Does that name some of what you sense is going on? Do you think this is over the top?
little over a year ago, my wife and I stopped at Minidoka, southern Idaho, which was one of the internment camps for the Japanese. There's a plaque at the entrance to that that says, this is a reminder of what not, what happens when people don't pay attention to the Constitution. At the same time, Arizona was passing a law that was all right to stop people of Hispanic descent because they look like they might be bad. We don't, we just forget about what we did to the Japanese.
Yep.
But doesn't fear come into that? I think a lot of people are so afraid of what is coming or what is here that they retreat back to what was and shutter their eyes to see anything beyond the what was.
Yeah. And I wonder if that fear isn't part of what drives so many into the throes of religious fundamentalism and violence and brutality and intolerance and judgmentalism. If we can only get back to a theocratic form of whatever, we will be not afraid.
That's kind
of
false memory.
And those absolutes, those certain things that at least we thought were certain.
Yes. We need a word there.
Exactly. Other comments?
Well, I just find it interesting that thinking about some remember, so I think that's a false memory we have. But I think we shift that. Even now we go back almost to a positive remembrance of the 30s. Of, well, look what we did back there when we got out of it. But when in the 70s, we were using the 50s as our positive memory. And then we got this positive memory of the 80s. And I just think we just struggle with our historic perspective and lack of, I think, that amnesia. The other thing, just to make me, I was thinking, I heard this a while back, it was about three umpires, differences of perception. The first umpire, the old umpire said, I call balls and strikes. The second one says, I call them as I see them. The third one says, postmodern, they ain't nothing until I call them.
Well, that's where we are.
That's right.
Carol?
On the last slide, on the culture of illusion, I think the manipulated emotions phrase is, I think, really important. I think that people do not just, you know, come to these illusions on their own. I mean, there is, I think, a going back to the past, but also that there's enormous amounts of money going into these, you know, this all the messaging, the sophistication of, I mean, it doesn't appear sophisticated on the surface, but the kind of manipulation and the money that goes into figuring out how to message things so that people end up believing things that aren't true. You know, it doesn't come out of thin air. It comes, you know, there's a lot of money behind it.
It's very carefully crafted. Well, and I think, you know, again, I don't want to depict this whole scenario, well, you know, we've got all this to rage against or whatever. But I think there is a real need for mainline Christians like people I'm assuming are in this room to really say, how do we break through all of that with a message, you know, with a clear enough analysis, because you can't just, it has to get a little bit in depth, but how do we communicate that in effective ways? I mean, at first we could say, oh, you know, look what we're up against with all of those ways in which those messages are getting through. But I don't think it's quite that hopeless. And I think how we communicate that, not just through words, but through actions, through sacraments, through all the rest, that, again, I think we're going to want to talk about. I think it's fair to say that these three slides are indicative of what people are feeling and aware of probably far more acutely than was true just a year or two ago. But the question is, are we really engaging that theologically? Exposing this and embodying what gospel means is an urgent calling today in and through faith communities, through ecclesia, for the sake of the whole endangered world, both the polis and the cosmos. So in the last part of this, for this evening, what I want to do is to begin to talk about that a little bit. How truth-telling, moving from the untruths that result in despair and powerlessness toward empowering kind of hope. Now certainly cross, resurrection, and eschatological hope are key in this. But how might this become more radically incarnate in the midst of these kinds of realities today? Not truth as something that is absolute or that belongs to anyone, but that is dynamic and continually being embodied or becoming incarnate. Truth-telling through subversive remembering of who and whose we are in relation to God, in relationship to what has come before us, and in relationship to neighbors who are left behind globally as well as locally. Subversive remembering has the potential, empowered through the Holy Spirit, to transform what is occurring in light of God's inbreaking reality. I'm going to put another slide up here that gives you a sense of what I'm referring to when I talk about subversive remembering. And just look at that and think about that while I'm talking about this. Now, if we assume an absolute sense of truth as unchanging words, that way of viewing things might not quite fit. It may sound as if we somehow enact what is usually thought of as the prerogative of God. And that's not where I'm going with this. I'm trying to think of how do we think of God as radically incarnate in a way that empowers us in the midst of this, that helps us see the reality of what's going on. To speak of truth in this sense is to speak of a kind of knowing. The truth-telling involved in theology is not a matter of process truth claims, but of a truth in process, with what Catherine Keller calls an open-ended interactivity. This truth-telling process is opened up through, again, subversive remembering, which is grounded in the memory of the suffering and crucified one, but in a way that has profound implications for what is occurring today. In reflecting on how I got into the subversive remembering theme, I realized much of it came about 30 years ago when I was reading Johann Baptist Metz, a German Catholic theologian, who wrote, among other things, a book, Freedom in History and Society. And he pointed out then that memory is the fundamental way of expressing Christian faith. In fact, and I think this was rather daring as a Catholic theologian, he viewed dogma as a way of formulating this dangerous memory. Quote, "The church's public witness is as bearer of the tradition of the dangerous memory of suffering and a yearning for freedom in the systems of domination of society," unquote. And since he wrote that some decades ago, I think we could also say that this isn't just within Christian confines, but we've perhaps witnessed some of this breaking out beyond the confines of the church in struggles for freedom and justice in places like Egypt and Libya and yes, even in the state of Wisconsin. Back to Metz. Christian faith is subversive memory, he says. We remember the future of our freedom in the memory of Christ's suffering. Subversive memory is not just past-oriented, but it is that which becomes present and moves us into the future, moves us beyond the captivity to the fear and the cynicism. Memories that are dangerous to the powers that be, because remembering suffering is itself subversive of any totalizing systems and the illusions they create. So I would, in terms of the last part of what I want to say this evening, for times such as these, when I think these illusions are beginning to crash in on people, people who are sitting in our churches, I think it's important for us to draw on, for example, Luther's theology of the cross as a way of knowing. And here I'm drawing on a very interesting little book by Mary Solberg, who teaches at Gustavus Adolphus College. The book's called Compelling Knowledge. And she talks that, about how through the cross there's a different way of seeing, and I would say also of remembering. For Luther, human knowing is theologically significant. In Luther's Heidelberg Thesis, especially Thesis 21 and 22, he writes, "A theologian comprehends what is of God through suffering and the cross. A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is." You know, the unveiling of the illusions, the etc. An epistemology of the cross critiques human pretensions to godness and equips us to see reality rightly. It attends to that moment when illusions fall apart. They no longer hold. We begin to see what is the case, to understand our implications in it, and to accept accountability to act accordingly. As Solberg puts it, the cross is a kind of fulcrum for knowing. It's the hinge point of true reality and the gift to see it. To know truly is to know from the margins, from the underside. From the underside of life, of sanity, of dignity, of power. Friends of the cross are those who live in the world as it is, without illusion. Continually challenged by what we see and how we interpret what we see. It permits us to enter more fully into the world with hope. We are brought into relationship with the reigning powers in this world, participating in the brokenness of the world. It is being there with the losers that scandalizes us and makes us wonder whether we have been running with the right God, unquote. That last quote is from Solberg. Yes, it is God's solidarity with the world who became radically incarnate that authorizes our own solidarity with those on the margins, including, and I think this is especially important, the increasing number who have not thought of themselves on the margins in the past, but who in fact are more and more becoming that, including, you know, the young adults who are saying, you know, the figures are the huge number who probably, of 20s and 30-year-olds, who probably will not see the standard of middle-class living that their parents enjoy. So the epistemology, this knowing through the cross, is a lens for exposing the illusions that are hidden beneath the official public scripts, between the slogans and the sound bites that continually bombard us, and that much of the world views quite skeptically when they ask, when will U.S. Americans and churches in the U.S. wake up and join the rest of the world? Not as an often unconscious imperial power, but as a partner in working collaboratively with others for the sake of the whole world. So the closing question that I would raise for us this evening is that question of how can more, how can more public theological outrage be inspired, expressed, and empower transformation in light of God's inbreaking new reality. So you can think about that, but I'm also here concluding with a slide that suggests some of the shifts that we're going to want to talk about, at least tomorrow. Because when we engage in this kind of subversive remembering that I'm saying again and again is inspired by the heart of what our faith is all about, our horizon shifts from illusions to reality, exposing truth of what is actually occurring. From focusing only above to also focusing below. And I mean that in two different ways. Not only, you know, thinking of, you know, a God off there rather than a God who's incarnate, but also how much our focus as Americans is focused on those who are above us, not just Americans, but, you know, we focus on, you know, those who are the successive, you know, the winners, you know, whether the sports heroes or all the other winners, and not necessarily on those who aren't the winners. Up rather than down. Shifting from very individualistic understandings of what's going on to more systemic understandings. And that's where certainly the empire understanding comes in there, but also some of the biblical scholars and theologians who have looked at what Paul is talking about when he talks about sin as a power of domination. In contrast to the very fairly individualistic ways that sin is often understood. Shifting from a U.S.-centric to a rest-of-the-world kind of focus. And then finally, last but certainly not least, from complicity with empire to allegiance to God's inbreaking reign. Now, I would hope, as we move through this, and this is where I think we're talking about collective wisdom of all of you. I'm hoping I can plant some seeds and we can continue talking about some of that during the week. Because this is really tough work, to really say, how do we think theologically about this? I mean, it's the tough work that whoever's preaching has to do every Sunday. You know, and whether, in fact, we feel up to that task, I think, is the question. Because to say, how does that gospel become good news in the midst of these kinds of realities? Not just saying, oh, yeah, that's the backdrop. But how do we say that so that the people hearing those sermons are saying, well, yeah, that preacher is speaking to the heart of what I understand now, but which much of the rest of the world is saying, well, just cover it over and, you know, get back to business as normal. And what if there's not a getting back to normal? How do we then think about that in American society, not to mention the whole world? So, I'm going to shut up for now, but if some of you want to make some comments or questions before we adjourn. Yes?
I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. I agree with the church speaking of power, and I agree that in mainline Christianity, I don't think it's being done very well or very effectively. The problem I have is I think we're a divided church, depending on how you speak of church. If you think of the church as the invisible church, then we are united. But if you speak of church as a cultural church, I think there's a lot of portions of that church that would say they are speaking truth and power. Mm-hmm. When they say we are God's, the United States is God's exclusive country, you know, manifest destiny and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I guess my question would be, I agree with your premise, and I agree that the situation is desperate because whoever controls the story controls the culture, mm-hmm. and we are not controlling. Our story is not getting out, or Christ's story is not getting out. But I guess the question is, you know, how do you do that with a quote visible church that is divided? And then, kind of as a footnote to that, I just spent some time back in Monticello in southern Ohio, kind of going through the beginning of this country and slavery and all of that stuff, and was just really amazed in my mind after reading some books on how the revolutionary culture was every bit like it is today, because back then the church was complaining that all of their colleges had been lost to infidels because they're all preaching deism and not, you know, Christianity, not Christ's story. But it seems to me in the Civil War period, even the Revolutionary War period, the visible church has always been divided. I like to think the invisible church is not divided, but I guess I know, how does the invisible church speak the message? I'm probably saying two or three things at once, but I do think it's a problem. Speaking some of the, and I do preach a lot of these messages that you've got up there, but I have a very patient congregation, but I think a lot of times when I preach what I feel is the story of Christ in the Word, I can be criticized that I'm not preaching the truth.
I think you posed the challenge we want to keep to. I don't want to answer your question right now.
No, you don't need to.
Because I think it's something for us all to chew on for a while. Chris.
One of the things that, while I like where you're going and I find it very helpful, I'm also concerned that times we don't confuse speaking the truth to power as regaining power we think we've lost.
Right.
It seems to me that one of the dangers of this discussion is we will begin to say only if we are successful have we been faithful, which again is counter the theology of the cross.
Right.
And so I think there is a dilemma here that we have to pay attention to so that we don't fall into that other ditch that can so easily be there.
Well, especially if it's then seen as another truth that could become controlling in another way.
Exactly.
And that's the difficulty, because if things are set up with, well, this is what's going on, you know, it's like, well, how do we develop that resistance that doesn't just fall in the same old trap on the other side?
I guess what I'm trying to articulate is that it seems like there's an unconscious perpetuation of some of the things we're talking about, even in where we're starting this conversation, which is that is with the clergy and the preaching that the text and context come together. And it just seems to me that, you know, this whole topic of radical incarnation and embodiment and stuff, that my experience and observation is that people get it when they're given opportunities to act on what I think a lot of people are feeling, which is, I'd like to be able to make a difference. I'd like to connect with people whose life situation isn't mine.
Right.
And then it seems like you begin to have conversations in context rather than kind of applying.
Yeah. No, I
at least
appreciate
that.
Actually, I wasn't going to even make the references to preaching that I did to
you. Oh, okay.
That was spontaneous, because part of what I'm going to say tomorrow is that it's the subversive remembering that comes through everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, and it's from below rather than somebody standing in a pulpit. And therefore, but at the same time, it's also a both and kind of thing.
Sure.
Sure. Okay. Are there other? We can keep talking about this tomorrow too. But I think it's also important to have lay people in this room too who can challenge us.
For a specific example, for example, Congress 6 months ago debated whether or not we should extend unemployment compensation to those who had been unemployed more than 26 weeks. Those people had really been hit by the recession that the economy is in and so on. So congressional representatives were standing up on both sides, some in favor and some opposed to it, by sort of denigrating those people who were unemployed and needed this sort of help. Now, it seems to me that that's an issue that the church somehow should tackle. And it should be spoken about, at least, from the pulpit. How do you do that? I don't hear that being talked about.
Well, I think there's such a host of issues that, you know, what happens to the most vulnerable or the common good that is, to me, the authorization for that in Scripture is across the board, and yet, you know.
But I don't think, I think you really have to get very specific about these issues and talk about, you know, political issues. You don't have to say, this is where I would go, or, you know, at least, you know, present the topics, present the pros and cons. Maybe more like a teacher would.
Are there any other comments before we conclude?
I just really am so engaged with those two words, subversive remembering. And it's taken me to a lot of different thoughts as you spoke. And I'm also reading now the Little Flowers of St. Francis of Assisi.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was considered subversive, as a Peter Waldo before him. And yet his remembering, you know, he was the outside the church person. He wanted to remain the lay person. He wanted that foundation in the Jesus, not in the structure.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was not structure, which is part of all these conversations, it was not an organized, it was finally to say with the people. And I was just accused recently of, as you were saying, not preaching the truth. And I realized I'm being social gospel. And I said, yeah, it's true. Because I was reading the scriptures, and they were about love, and they were about forgiveness. And I thought, am I supposed to go around those? Or do you just head right through them? And that's what really got me into the St. Francis part, because it is so subversive. And what still continues to amaze me is, in that time period of the 1200s, he sent people out two by two. They reached all the way to Finland and all these places because they thought that subversive love was powerful.
That's what happened. Good. I think that's a good final comment for this evening.